across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense from the shores of Lake Wissota, where it's a beautiful day up north. It's Wednesday, July 12th, first day of the Northern Wisconsin State Fair. I can just about see the fairgrounds across a couple of cornfields here in Chippewa. 57 degrees up here on the lake for folks listening on our Civic Media home base, 93.5 The Tap. But maybe you're listening to the Shaw down in Waukesha. It's 55 degrees there. La Crosse coming in at 60, Minocqua at 56 degrees. Here's what's on tap this morning, and there is a lot of it. In this week's Climate Check with Melissa Baldoff, we're going to visit with State Assembly Representative Katrina Shanklin of Stevens Point. We're going to talk about Governor Evers' new Green Ribbon Commission on Clean Energy and Environmental Innovation. The group is going to be identifying public-private financing opportunities to invest in clean energy and strengthen infrastructure, reduce reliance on imported energy, create jobs. We're going to hear a lot from Representative Shanklin coming up. We will talk to Rebecca Cook. She is the first Democrat to announce a campaign aimed at unseating Republican Congressman Derek Van Orden in the 3rd District. And Up North News has a new reporter, but an old friend, Selena Heller. She and I used to work together at WEAU Channel 13 in Eau Claire for many years. And on this first day of the Northern Wisconsin State Fair, we're going to talk about that fair and the many other ways to enjoy fairs, state fair, county fair, district fairs, like the Northern Wisconsin one. We're going to visit with Melissa Kay from locally grown radio, WFHR in Wisconsin Rapids. We're going to talk to Todd Alba near the end of the show, and we're going to tell you about a new statewide blood donation competition, giving that pint of blood for something called Civic Pints from Civic Media, which could win you a prize, but more importantly, help out with a true blood shortage across Wisconsin, which could affect you if you were to get ill or in an accident or something like that. So details on that are coming up. And then, of course, along the way, our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789, or send us a note, radio at upnorthnewswi.com. And with that, we bring in Aaron Zommers down in the Madison studio, who, there he is. Sometimes I click the right button. Sometimes I don't. Morning, Aaron.
Morning.
We had, there were showers that had threatened to come into western and northwest Wisconsin. Here on the lake, they all managed to break up before we got more than maybe a handful of drops. I'm guessing, are things dry down there? Did that front finally make it down and bring you some more precip? What do you got going?
I believe it rained a little bit last night. I know as I was falling asleep, I heard it.
Okay.
But my room isolates the outside pretty well, so I'm not 100% sure that it rained. I'm just pretty sure.
Same here. Sometimes you think you hear a rumble of thunder, but yeah, when you've got that really early bedtime. Although I am thankful for a bedtime that isn't as early as other folks. I was talking about TV 13, and Bob Gallagher anchors the morning news there now in Eau Claire. He was the sportscaster when I was anchoring the news, 18, 20 years ago now. But now Bob is there. I wake up at 4:30, I flip on my TV, and there's Bob. And Bob and I were texting yesterday, and he needled me a bit that I get to sleep in until 4:30 because his wake-up alarm is at 2:30 in the morning.
Oh, gross.
It is gross, but so I'm thankful not to have that. I was able to stay up late enough to watch just the first couple innings of the All-Star game. I know you said you missed it, but I think you would have enjoyed it simply because they had multiple players mic'd up and they're talking to the players, while they're out in the field. And, I really liked them. They were good characters. They were all, joking around, having a good time. I think I really enjoyed that, except for they actually mic'd up the pitcher at one point, or I guess at 2 points in the game. And that was almost nerve-wracking because he's trying to figure out what pitch he wants to throw. But at the same time, he's kind of whispering an answer like, well, I think I might throw him the sinker. It's like, that was a little nerve-wracking having that. But I still, overall, I think we could mic up more players during baseball games.
Overall, that sounds pretty cool. Yeah, definitely a lot of fun, I bet.
It was because, you know, I've heard some people complain like, oh, the All-Star game is not as competitive as it used to be. Well, it's not. You're talking about millionaire athletes now. These aren't, you know, this isn't Pete Rose. Okay. This isn't 1973. Nobody's going to be barreling into the catcher, you know, like a Mack truck or something like that. It is much more of an exhibition than it used to be. There's not as much motivation. So if you're going to have an exhibition, but you want them to get the most out of it, if you can mic them up, because then they're going to get a little competitive with each other. I feel like they're going to be joshing each other and wanting to show off for each other. So there you go. That's my sports science theory on why the All-Star game is a little better than it used to be.
You know, I think I'm going to have to agree. You know, I haven't seen it, but that sounds like it's an improvement.
I'll bet it's something they continue. Yeah.
So I think
We'll get a chance to see that. And by the way, there was a game, and the National League won for the first time since 2012, beating the American League by a score of 3-2. Okay, the Up North News newsletter comes out every morning. It is out now, and it includes an article and a link to the full article on our webpage about how President Biden is cracking down on junk insurance plans, health insurance plans that exploit many Americans. And on the Up North News social media sites, we include a link to that video, if you haven't seen it yet, of former Packers great Donald Driver trying to do the Lake Geneva mailboat jump, where they have to jump onto a dock, grab the mail, and then jump back onto the boat before it goes past. And Donald Driver, he did okay. He did better than I would do. I'd be very wet, but he still had a little mishap. We have some serious headlines to talk about in the news, unfortunately, because some political activity hasn't taken a break yet, so we're following it. Those details are coming up next. You're up north. Well, getting back to the All-Star game for just a second here, although Corbin Burns and Devin Williams made the All-Star roster, neither player pitched last night in Seattle. So we have news about a different Brewers pitcher, well, at least a former Brewers pitcher. The Brewers announced this week that they will induct former pitcher Ben Sheets into the Walk of Fame outside American Family Field next month. That'll happen on the evening of August 26th. When the Brewers take on the San Diego Padres, a home plate made of granite will be set in the ground, and Sheets will throw a ceremonial first pitch ahead of the game. Ben Sheets had a 10-year big league career, 8 of them with the Brewers, after they selected him 10th overall in the 1999 draft. He was the first Brewers pitcher ever to start an All-Star game back in 2008, and a lot of fans still remember 2004 when he struck out a franchise record 18 batters in a complete game home victory over Atlanta. And of course, the Brewers, as we've mentioned before, will be in Cincinnati starting Friday for a weekend series once the All-Star break is completed. You know, I would love to tell you that it's the start of a quiet summer for politics. We kind of thought it would be once the state budget bill had been signed, and then there were partial vetoes by the governor. And we thought maybe things would be quiet from now until, you know, September or October. Unfortunately, there are still people in positions of power who do things that either make a lot of noise but accomplish nothing, and nothing productive anyway, or they do things that are outright harmful to many Americans and many of their own constituents. And the case in point was put on display last night in Iowa, where the legislature, led by Republicans, came into special session in order to pass a basically total ban on abortions. I mean, they say it's a 6-week abortion ban, but, you know, many women have no idea that they're pregnant during the first 6 weeks. So you've removed their right to make a choice about something they just learned about their body. I mean, imagine making chemotherapy or any other medical care illegal unless started within 6 weeks of something changing in your body. But here's what to me is more galling. While Iowa Republicans can technically claim they added an exception for rape and incest, their actions last night were most decidedly pro-rapist. And there is no other way to put it. For someone who has been sexually assaulted, someone who's been violated, possibly beaten, living with trauma and fear, possibly someone who still must deal with this person on a daily basis. Maybe it's a spouse, a boyfriend, a roommate, a boss. And in those instances, an abortion is only maybe allowed if she reports the sexual assault to police or a health provider within 45 days. In other words, about 6 weeks. And for incest victims, 145 days. 145. Where do they pluck these numbers? Not from anything based in healthcare, not in anything rooted in science. They're made up because it feels good for a politician to say they've created policy complete with metrics like 45 and 145 days, but are based in nothing. Here's our next case in point. Republicans doubling down on supporting a fugitive charged with being an unregistered agent for China, brokering illegal arms sales, and violating U.S. economic sanctions. This is a guy who is mixed up with China and Iran and Libya. So it's no surprise that someone in his position might be saying anything to try to beat the rap, hoping that someone is foolish enough to believe him. And as we first told you about yesterday, there are, in fact, people who are foolish enough to believe him. And those would be some of the Republicans in the United States Congress, Senator Ron Johnson among them. But especially so would be James Comer, the Kentucky Republican who heads up the Oversight Committee for the House of Representatives. And this is somebody who has repeatedly, I mean, when you talk about Hunter Biden derangement syndrome, I mean, this guy is at the top of the list. And asked again yesterday about the fugitive charged with essentially being, you know, a borderline spy for China, Comer, like Ron Johnson before him, said, well, clearly the U.S. Department of Justice must be making things up against this guy because they want to quash whatever dirt he's got on Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, except for this minor detail that he hasn't actually provided anything, whereas there's plenty of things that he has done that the Department of Justice has found and has turned into criminal charges because they rose to that level. Now, the Law and Order Republicans that I used to know would look at that from a Law and Order standpoint and say, this guy may be innocent until proven guilty, but it certainly does necessitate a trial whenever we can get one started because currently he's a fugitive. But instead, they are choosing to put party first, choosing to put politics first, saying, well, this guy, you know, might be a bad guy, or maybe he's not. Maybe we're making things up because we're so sure we want to smear somebody else, even though we don't have anything about Hunter Biden or President Biden that rises to the level of even considering something criminal. And then in our third instance, you've got Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville, the former college football coach turned a politician, who is blocking the confirmation of hundreds of military officers because he wants to play politics with abortion. The same Tommy Tuberville who has finally acknowledged that white nationalists are racists. I know some of you are looking kind of funny at the radio right now, but yes, he has repeatedly, recently, been asked to denounce white nationalists, people who believe that white people are superior to other races. He was asked, should white nationalists be allowed to serve in the military? And he said white nationalists were just Americans and suggested that they be allowed to serve. Asked another time last week, he said a white nationalist is simply, again, quote, an American arguing that all white nationalists aren't racist, even if the ideology is inherently racist. So when a CNN anchor pushed back and said, senator, a white nationalist, is someone who believes the white race is superior to other races. Senator Tuberville pushed back on the definition and said, well, that's just some people's opinion. No, it's not an opinion. He says, my opinion of a white nationalist, if somebody wants to call them a white nationalist to me, is an American. They're an American. He says he's always been against any white nationalists who are racist and against any kind of racism. But he seemed to suggest that if white nationalists were banned from serving in the military, it would, quote, do away with most white people in the country. Does that not sound like the senator from Alabama to you and me? This is somebody who could not be more wrong. And yet at the same time, because he is upset about the abortion issue, he is now blocking every single military nomination in the United States Senate, which is gumming up the works. It's obstructing military nominees from getting their confirmation votes. And so they're not able to take on their new positions. They're not able to pack up with their families to move to wherever they're going to be stationed next. They cannot enroll their children in new schools. We mentioned that this week is the anniversary of the United States Marine Corps reforming after the Revolutionary War. For the first time in its history this week, the Marines do not have a commander. They have an interim commander, but this person has not received a confirmation vote. For the first time in the history of the United States Marines, there is not a confirmed leader. And that person is not unconfirmed because of a problem with that person at all. There's nothing wrong with their honor. There's nothing wrong with their service to country. There is something wrong with the fact that a single United States senator can hold up hundreds of military confirmations. We have a system that is not working as the founding fathers intended. There was nothing intentionally put in by the founders of this country that said that one senator, much less one from the Deep South who doesn't think that all white nationalists are racist, nothing that says one senator should be able to hold up military confirmations or federal judgeships, you know, the so-called blue slip procedure. And of course, you're all familiar with the filibuster in the United States Senate. Again, not an original creation. Where are the originalists? Where are the strict constructionists who are saying that can't be? That's not what the founders intended. And yet that's exactly what we have right now in the Senate, which is inherently, I said some things, you know, the founding fathers didn't intend. Unfortunately, some of the things the founders did intend are also faulty and are still with us. The fact that the Dakotas has four U.S. senators among them because they just coincidentally split the area into two states, North Dakota and South Dakota. So they've got four senators, while Wisconsin, with a higher population, has two, and you know, places like California and New York with significantly higher populations have two. It's a wacky system. And so let's not make it wackier by bringing in ways to gum up the works the way that the senator from Alabama is doing. One more note, a little bit closer to home, the Milwaukee Common Council has passed a 2% sales tax. It was something that was part of the big agreement by Governor Evers and legislative Republicans. It allows the city and then the Milwaukee County as well to take in much needed revenue. And it caused a lot of consternation before the vote came. And it did get the 2/3 vote necessary. So it did pass. And people saying, well, it's another instance of our taxes going up and those local politicians raising our taxes. And coincidentally, up here, the city of Eau Claire is again talking about a so-called wheel tax, basically a vehicle registration fee. And again, city leaders are getting an earful about that. And I'm hoping that the message is starting to finally get through. Your anger is misdirected at city leaders in Eau Claire, at city leaders in Milwaukee. at county leaders in Milwaukee County and all the other counties with county sales taxes. They didn't do this. The Republicans who have run the state legislature for 12 years have done this. Even in a year with a $7 billion surplus, they wanted to send half of it to tax cuts for the very wealthy. And then again, force school boards, city councils, and county boards to be the bad guys because state legislators refused to be an equal partner in the responsible stewardship of your tax dollars. We will take a break, and then our weekly climate check is coming up with Melissa Baldoff and State Representative Katrina Shanklin. Right after this, you're up north. Let's do a little climate check for the week, and we're going to do it with a member of the Wisconsin legislature, and we're checking the climate around her now. We needed a week or two to cool off, Melissa Baldoff, before we bring in Representative Katrina Shanklin. There always needs to be a cooling off period after a legislative floor session about the state budget. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely. I definitely would. And, you know, this was a session where, you know, there was a lot of things going on. A lot was accomplished. An important large budget that made some incredibly important investments in local communities, in cleaning up our drinking water, some really important issues for folks around the state. So, you know, I think with so much going on, definitely needed that little bit of a cooling off period. But it's also, I think, a great opportunity to start talking about all those fantastic things that happen in the budget. And of course, you know, was this a perfect budget? No. Is it what everyone wanted? No. But it's still, I think, very important to talk about the investments that are going to make a difference when it comes to, you know, protecting our natural resources, you know, investing in conservation and resiliency efforts, I think are really important wins. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the veto heard around the world. So, you know, an important reminder that the governor has a very powerful pen and is not afraid to use it. And, you know, one of the reasons he is able to use that power is because we have fantastic advocates in the state legislature like Representative Shanklin. So I'm really excited she is able to be with us today.
And joining us from Stevens Point, Representative, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have been, a tireless advocate for clean water for years. And so this budget does make an investment in clean water and in fighting PFAS. What can you tell us about that and how it measured up against your hopes and priorities for a state budget?
Sure. So I think this budget, in terms of clean water and water quality, especially as it relates to agriculture, continued some of the bills that I have been working on with my colleagues for years, and several programs which specifically help farmers target runoff and prevent runoff altogether by controlling their loading practices, especially as it relates to nitrogen and phosphorus. So I'm very excited about the continued investments in those programs. That's huge, especially here in Portage County. We have 1 in 4 people in Portage County can't drink water from their taps if they have a private well. And that needs to be fixed. We need to be investing in preventative measures, and this budget continue the work that we've been doing for a while on that, which I'm excited about. In really big news, there was also a $125 million PFAS trust fund, and that's huge. I'm very excited about it, but I'm only excited if we can actually use it, right? And there's an asterisk sometimes when you see numbers and headlines and you get excited about all the ways that money can marshal into communities across the state, like Wausau, like Peshtigo and Marinette, and French Island near La Crosse. And instead, the DNR is really going to have to file 1310 requests. It's a wonky term that basically means they have to ask permission of the Republican Joint Finance Committee, the Republican Budget Committee, to use that money. And so that's the disappointment. I think if Republicans are very serious about PFAS, and some of them are finally saying that they are, what they could have done better through this budget is they could have provided that $125 immediately with the snap of a finger to communities across the state for testing for PFAS, for remediation of PFAS, and for upgrading their water treatment plants, like Wausau had to do on their own dime, which means ratepayers had, I believe it was over 50% of an increase. And it was originally only projected to be a 40% increase in water bills. So as you can imagine, that's a pretty hefty cost for an average Wisconsin family to have to take on. So what I want to do is encourage my Republican colleagues to work across the aisle and especially work with Governor Evers on finding a path forward so that we can expediently and efficiently get that money out. There's a bill right now in the legislature where, from my perspective, it appears they're trying to micromanage Governor Evers and the DNR in getting that money out the door. And again, if they're serious about PFAS, about testing and remediation, they can work with us to get that money out the door now and not later.
Okay, let's turn to a different funding source and some extra duties for you. You have been appointed to the governor's Green Ribbon Commission on Clean Energy and Environmental Innovation. I think I got that right. And it's going to administer something called the Green Innovation Fund, which, as I understand it, involves both public and private funding. Tell me about the commission, about the fund. What is it that people will see from this investment fund with the work that you're going to be doing?
Absolutely. So there are a few examples across the nation to look for people who are interested in what a Green Innovation Fund can look like. Some states call them clean energy innovators. Some states call them green banks. I think what the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is doing under the leadership of Governor Tony Evers is really finding their own model that works. And I am extremely excited not only to be appointed as a commissioner, but also to meet and work with all of the fellow commissioners who have a breadth and variety of experience across the state. I think they have nonprofit experience, financial sector experience. They have so much experience in clean energy, obviously, but if we're going to get to our goals of a carbon-free future by 2050, we need to make sure we're scaling up clean energy. And so what this new fund is going to do is leverage private and public investments using federal investments. For example, we have some funds from the bipartisan infrastructure law, as well as the infrastructure funds recently that are absolutely enormous. There's billions of dollars to be spent thanks to Democrats in Congress and President Biden. And I think when it comes to the Inflation Reduction Act specifically, that's going to affect and personally help so many businesses, whether it's manufacturers and farmers, as well as small businesses and families who really need support if they're going to invest in both energy efficiency and renewable energy. So we're going to be taking some of those dollars. We're going to be looking at ways to actually leverage private investment like other states have done. When it comes to clean energy, Wisconsin was not a leader for a long time. And I think as soon as Governor Evers came in, you can see the change. There's a coalition of businesses. There's a coalition of farmers and agriculture who are leading on clean energy. There's a coalition of utilities who are working on scaling up. And I think Governor Evers has really led the way with his clean energy plan. So this builds on his clean energy plan. And the work that we're going to do is not just goal setting, which is great and important, right? We should have objectives, but we're actually going to be helping chart a course for what a clean energy accelerator or green bank can look like in Wisconsin. And the reason this is so important to me is I've been working in the legislature for a long time on a bill to do just this. I had legislation that I had been working really hard to make bipartisan because I wanted to see this happen in Wisconsin. And I say every day, thank God for Tony Evers because he came along and made my legislation irrelevant, and he did it with the stroke of a pen. So I want to thank him for his tremendous and bold leadership. I don't think enough people understand how much he utilizes his executive authority to make transformational, long-term, and generational change in Wisconsin. And this is one of those things that I believe 10 years from now, everyone will look back and say, wow, we really took the Green Innovation Fund creation for granted, but look at how much it's scaled up clean energy in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and that I think that's a really great point. You know, the way that the governor is able to, you know, use his executive authority on something like this, and it is such a transformational opportunity. It seems, you know, a great opportunity for job growth in this state too. You know, we're hearing a lot about the clean energy economy and the jobs that are going to be available, and these are going to be good paying jobs that many of them don't require a college degree, good paying union jobs, a lot of them. So Is that something that you're encouraged to see as well?
Absolutely. We have at our disposal about $27 billion in competitive funds for states and nonprofits that are working with community financing institutions for clean energy. So we have a lot of money that can be invested in our local economies. That isn't just money that goes into a main street. It's also money that goes into families' pockets. And you're absolutely right when it comes to union jobs. I think of the IBEW, for example. They're working on the majority of utility investor-owned projects, investor-owned utility projects for large-scale solar. But when we look at small-scale solar, I think we really haven't seen that kind of rocketing of investment in small-scale solar that other states have, because frankly, the legislature hasn't acted to make it easier for families to afford it. So I think that's one thing that the Green Innovation Fund can look at, is it's not only helping families and small businesses and manufacturers and agriculture get into that investment, but then the other side of it is these are family supporting jobs that cannot be outsourced. When you're installing a solar EV, for example, I should say a solar panel, and then for your EV, because some people want their new electric vehicle to be powered by the sun. So you get a double investment there. You want somebody who knows not only the electric code, but is well trained and they're getting paid well, and hopefully they're in your local community. And that's the thing that I think more and more people are going to see, is they realize that this is affordable now with the Inflation Reduction Act and all the incentives available. And down the road, I think it will be even more affordable when this Green Innovation Fund gets up and running.
I think there's something psychological as well about the Green Innovation Fund. And look, the phrase public-private partnerships gets bandied about a lot. And there are folks who rightly say there are some things that only the public sector should be taking care of. And there are people who say there are some things that should just be left to the private sector. But it seems to me part of the thing that works so well with this is it's about building some trust. There's private sector people that say, well, if the public sector is jumping into this too, then I don't feel like I'm going to be, cut off on a limb. And if taxpayers look at this and say, it's not just a government job, it's government investing in something that's going to create jobs, a Green Innovation Fund seems to be, a textbook case of how you would do public-private partnerships.
I completely agree. And I think the commissioners that the governor has assembled to help manage and set guiding principles of the Green Innovation Fund really speaks to the breadth and depth of experience that they have in the private sector, as well as the diversity and representation of all parts of Wisconsin. And I think that's really exciting. You're absolutely right. When other people take the risk first, more people are likely to follow. And I think this Green Innovation Fund is going to help with private investment to the point where people will say it's a worthy public investment too.
So this is kind of a fun one, I think. The budget included some funding to support conservation efforts around the state, which is great. Especially this time of year, it's wonderful to be thinking about it, because we're all trying to get outside and enjoy the weather over the summer. And now that the air is cleaned up a little bit for us. So I just wanted to ask, what is your favorite state park?
That would be Newport State Park in Allison Bay. I love Lake Michigan, and it has some incredible views. And then the geological formations, I know that's a little bit nerdy, but it's amazing to see the trees there and how they're built into the rock. So they're just growing through the rock. So I want people to know it's kind of further up the thumb if you're in Newport County, but it's always worth the trip. It's one of my favorite places in the whole state.
Melissa, that might be one of my favorite political answers of the year, because what every other legislator tends to do is, I can't pick a favorite. Not Katrina, man. You ask her a question, she's going to give you an answer. Love it. I got time for just one quick thing. We're past the budget. You may not be back in till September, October. What does a state representative do besides the parades, of course? But do you get to do a family trip? Do you have a hammock and say, leave me in this hammock until Labor Day? What's your favorite thing to do?
Yeah, well, I do have a hammock and I read in it. I have books this thick. probably like 10 books deep right now of things that I would like to get through. And I always have like my nerdy books where I learn something, and then my escapism books where I just deal in fantasy and pretend like I'm in that book. But I would say, I have parades every other week and fairs, and every weekend there's events. So for me, it isn't really vacation. It's more just being home and being in the community even more, which I love and appreciate the most, Frank. So I'm excited to get some summer reading in, I have a goal to get to a different park every weekend as well in between parades and fairs. So that's one of the things. We have lots of great county parks in Portage County and lots of little lakes, rivers, and streams. So that's another thing that I like to do.
Wow. And Melissa, this commission is going to open up a whole world of people that you have met and worked with for us to talk to on these weekly visits, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
All right. Melissa Baldoff and Katrina Shanklin, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks.
You too.
And Pat
and
will be
still ahead. You know, there should be just like some kind of a splat, a pie in the face, you know, thing to give me to play when I forget to unmute my microphone. Anyway, as I was saying, still ahead in our 7 o'clock hour, congressional candidate Rebecca Cook, new Up North News reporter Selena Heller, and of course, Todd Alba. But coming up next, today's history lesson and music break with Melissa Kay from Locally Grown Radio. We'll be back. You're Up North. Could it feel any more like summer if we're playing the Beach Boys as we are on this July 12th and being joined by Melissa Kay of Locally Grown Radio in Wisconsin Rapids, WFHR. Hello, Melissa.
Good morning, Pat.
How are you out there?
Oh, I'm great.
Yes?
Okay. Yeah, I have coffee.
How was your 4th of July, your long holiday weekend?
It was short because I didn't have Monday off.
Okay.
But busy. I saw family and then I traveled up to Tomahawk and saw friends. So it was busy.
Great. Any fireworks shows as part of it?
No.
Nope.
Okay. I go to bed early.
Yeah. Same here. And like I've said, I live on a lake, so it's like theater in the round because everybody's shooting off fireworks. So
yeah.
Well, California Girls was released by the Beach Boys on this day in 1965. Let's see. I think we've only got... Yeah, only one birthday here, and that would be Walter Egan, who gave us the 1970s hit Magnet and Steel. He was born this day in 1948, so what is that, 75 years old today for Walter Egan of Queens, New York.
Yeah.
This would have been the birthday for Christine McVie, who passed away last October, born this day in 1943. She was born Christine Ann Perfect in England. This is one of her solo hits, Got a Hold on Me. Isn't it always unfortunate that some people just don't seem to get their due until after they're no longer with us? And you know, it was after Christine McVie passed away a few months back that I think people were finally saying publicly what wasn't said nearly enough was how key she was, not just her vocal talents, but her songwriting to Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah. A lot to live up to with the last name of Perfect.
Well, yeah, you can see, I don't know the story as to why she changed it from Christine Perfect to Christine McVie. Well, of course, she got married to John McVie, so maybe I guess there is a story there after all, but I don't know. I would have been tempted to keep it Perfect as a stage name.
Why not?
It's probably a lot.
Little pressure. Yeah.
I always like these little stories we find on the interwebs about on a certain day, you know that something happened that was formative to somebody who would later go on to become a famous singer. And this time around, coincidentally, because of Fleetwood Mac, the story is about Stevie Nicks. It was on this day in 1970. Stevie Nicks was part of a local band called Fritz, and they were at the Santa Clara County Fairgrounds in California. And Stevie Nicks and her local band Fritz opened up for, they were opening act for Janis Joplin on this day in 1970. And Stevie Nicks said she was just dumbstruck watching Joplin perform and gives Janis Joplin credit for showing her how to connect with an audience from the stage. And that really, when you get to why does Stevie Nicks, why does she consistently get more attention than Christine McVie? It was because Stevie Nicks had that presence on a stage. And now we see she got it on, you know, in part from Janis Joplin on this day 53 years ago. I hate to, you know, some songs you just look for a reason not to play, but there's slim pickings on the calendar today. So this was the number one song this day in 1969.
In the year 35.
That's such a bleak song, but it was the number one song this week in 1969 when man first landed on the moon. In the year 2525 by Zager and Evans, a bleak sci-fi song where humankind gradually destroys itself. It actually stayed number one for 6 weeks, which tells you something about the national mood in 1969. I don't know that I've ever not reached for the dial when the song comes on one of those oldie stations.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't heard it that many times to actually even know what the story was about.
It's just bleak. How familiar are you with Disco Demolition Night at Comiskey Park, which was this day in 1979?
Not at all.
Oh, really? See, that's just legendary. I think probably in part because of being such a baseball fan. But it was on this night that Disco Demolition Night, which was supposed to be one of those novelty things between games of a doubleheader between the White Sox and the Tigers, went horribly wrong. The plan between the games was to declare that Disco was dead, because people were starting to get sick of Disco by, you know, the summer of 79. And mm-hmm. So they asked everybody to bring their Disco records, because everybody still listened to records back then. They were going to put them all in a pile and they were going to blow it up. But they put too much, I don't know if it was TNT or what it was that they were using to blow it up, but they overdid it.
Uh-oh.
It just blew a hole in the outfield.
Oh, no.
Scattered stuff everywhere. The crowd went unruly, started rushing onto the grounds, and eventually the White Sox had to forfeit the second game of the doubleheader because they couldn't control the crowd.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then they had a hole in their outfield. How could they play anyway?
And that was the brainchild of Mike Veck, who was the son of legendary Bill Veck, both of them big-time baseball promoters. Mike Veck would later redeem himself quite handsomely, bringing in a little minor league team I'd like to call the St. Paul Saints, which were wildly successful with incredible promotions that go on to this day. Mm-hmm. One more song note on this day. In 2004, we got the debut single from Sugarland.
Stay up all night. Well, I don't know, can't see them for the glow of the neon lights. And
this was Baby Girl. It was released this day in 2004, went all the way to number two on the country tally. But here's the thing, when Sugarland came out with a bang, this song stayed on the chart for 46 weeks.
Wow.
So, yeah, so clearly there was Jennifer Nettles and the rest of the band. They knew they were onto something good here.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, tell me, Melissa Kay, what's new at Locally Grown Radio, and what can folks get if they either listen live or over the interwebs to you?
Well, this week we actually have cast members from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory are coming on to Midday Magazine to talk with James tomorrow. So that's from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. We'll be talking with them. That's the kids production for the Wisconsin Rapids Community Theater. They are premiering their show on, I want to say, the 21st and 22nd of July. So it's going to be fun to talk with them.
Yeah, that will be great. Okay, good. Mm-hmm. Hey, did you follow at all that Elton John has finally wrapped up his farewell tour?
So I heard.
Yeah. In Stockholm, Sweden over the weekend on Saturday.
And who was it that came to like congratulate him? Was it Coldplay?
Oh, I don't know. Aaron,
yeah, there was another band.
Did you hear one way or the other?
I don't recall, but I know that I'm shocked that he actually wrapped it up, because Elton John does not strike me as the kind of person who can just sit with himself and not be making music.
Plus, yeah.
He sounds amazing still at, what, 74?
76, I think.
Six?
Yeah.
And still, I mean, he sounds sick.
Here it is.
50.
Yep. 76. He did 330 shows on the farewell tour to more than 6 million fans. Just amazing. We should be so lucky to have that kind of longevity. Melissa Kay, thank you so much. Great to talk to you as always.
You too, guys.
All right. Have a wonderful day. And our newest addition at Up North News, Selena Heller, is standing by and will join us next. You're Up North.